Okay, can you hear me loud and clear? 1, 2, 3, Adam Peacock, Stan Lazaridis.
Yep, gotcha.
We're back in action.
We're back.
Batman and Robin back together again, the two Cape Crusaders.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Fox Football Podcast, brought to you all the way from sunny Perth. And I will say it's sunny, it's 36 degrees, not a cloud in the sky. And beautiful over here. They say it's God's country in this part of the world, and this man is going to try and indoctrinate me to believe it full on. It's one of WA's finest products when it comes to football, Stan Lazaridis.
Yeah, morning, Adam.
Thanks. We are in God's country, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, we high-fived him just a minute ago, and as you said, beautiful sunny conditions, and it's good to kind of catch up and reminisce and go back in time and remember who I used to be. But having said all of that, certainly we've picked the right day for it.
When you say we remember who we used to be, we're not going to go into too much detail. We shared a tour to Russia in 2018 at the World Cup.
Now, that was interesting.
It's not that I don't want to bring up some stories there. I just can't remember many.
Probably there was a lot of drinking, and obviously we got all emotional with our boys and supporting Australia. So it was a great turnout, many supporters. We had a lot of fun, and it's a shame we couldn't go a bit further in the competition.
Now, you're obviously born and bred in this part of the world, and you've come back here. So you went full circle. You went round and round the globe chasing a football. Who got you into it? How did you start? Because there is a strong football community in this part of the world.
Yeah, I think, I, along with many others, it was from immigrants, mum and dad that come over, and a lot of the time was you'd go to your local game and there was other people there, and eventually you kind of got drawn into the game, and I would be watching my brother play, and they were short one time a player, and then I filled in and I was pretty good, and then it just really went on from there. And for me it was like that was the outing each week, was to go to your soccer club. And the soccer club was ethnic based in those days. And so generally the people in the community would congregate around those clubs. And then after a while, I realised I was actually okay. And then we really went from there. And I think many of the other stories, the other players, and you talk about your Ned Zelichs and, Mark Badoukas and all these sort of superstars that became, we actually didn't realise we were any good until later on. And it's kind of weird in reflection, but certainly there were some happy times.
You had to go to Adelaide, though, to go up a grade. How tough was that, leaving everything behind here, or was it just something absolutely necessary?
Well, for me, I had no choice, really. If I was to further my career, I had to leave Perth. We weren't in the NSL, I think it was those days, National Soccer League. And so I had trials with Heidelberg and Preston Macedonia in Melbourne. And then in the end, I was lucky where Raoul Blanco, who became kind of like my father, really, he was the one that convinced me to go to West Adelaide. And the club was from a Greek background until all the ethnic cleansing happened, a couple of years after that. Mm. And so I wasn't given an opportunity at West Adelaide, and it really set me up really nicely. And having someone like Raoul Blanco as my coach, mentor, father, just everything. He was all in one, and he was hard and tough. But I guess he was like that because he really did believe in me. And I guess he could see a career for me. And, I thank him every time I see him because all the extra training sessions he would hold during the day, his barbecues at night and the way he used to cut the meat into these brontosaurus-sized steak things. And he goes, Stanley, you eat this one. You become bigger, stronger. You have to eat this one. And I'm like, bloody hell, Raoul, how am I going to get through that? And then he'd put on a tape of Barcelona and Real Madrid. He's got it in Spanish. And then he just threw everything down you. You just absorbed it. And it really kind of, I've got kind of a tear in my eye thinking about it, but it was one of those that it was invaluable, Adam. That would never happen today. Just those things don't happen today.
Is a person like Raoul Blanco, who was involved in the national team setup in one way or another, be it junior national teams or senior Socceroos, do people like that get enough credit in Australian football?
Unfortunately not, you know, in that time there was kind of just a select group. You had like your Eddie Thompsons, Les Scheinvlogs, Frank Arock, and we've worked with Frank and Raoul, and I guess we didn't realise how good we had it with those guys. And then we felt then with this draw card of bringing this whole Dutch Revolution, the Belgian guys, and that was all good as well, but they were given so much more credit to what these guys were. They didn't get paid that well either. And I'm not there to judge on the finance side of things, but, you know, and they genuinely cared. I'm not saying this, the other guys didn't, but they were more in it for themselves, where these guys, Rowles, Blankos, and they lived in the area, and Raoul was from that Parramatta kind of the western suburbs area. So he'd be waking up every day and he'd be unearthing these gem of players and conditioning them, because we never had a structure. After we play a game, it was like, you know, eat a steak and chips and have a sundae and an ice cream and this. And I mean,
was this, you know, national teams or with NSL days?
NSL days, and even leading into the national team. Yeah, it was. It's just, you know, we weren't really disciplined over that until people like Raoul Blanco. I remember Raoul Blanco screaming at me for going up having two plates of food. And he goes, "You're wearing out the carpet. You've gone up that many times to the buffet." And I said, "Raoul, I've only had a small plate. I didn't want to mix with food." He goes, "Stanlio, you'd say to me, yeah, last week you moved like a Ferrari. This week you're like a Fiat." I said, Raoul, I don't eat that. And we had a laugh, and he remembers that story, and Robbie Hooker will say it again. And I don't fill my plates up that big.
No.
So, but it was good. I mean, he was just educating me. And
he just knew how to handle it.
He did. Spot on. Yeah.
Knew how to handle you guys. I love the story. And can you go into it in great detail? Because it's almost like a romantic story, how you got spotted by a club.
Yeah,
overseas, and how you ended up there, because there are ways of scouting players, and these days it feels like you have to do this YouTube compilation or send over 10 DVDs and have the right agent at the right time. That wasn't quite your story.
No, I mean, it is a kind of sliding door moment, I guess. But for me, I was in Adelaide, and I was told to come up. The promoter that was promoting this game with West Ham wanted me to come over and
Back to Perth.
I'm playing this game with the WA state team against West Ham. And I said, "Oh, look, I'm not sure, you know, I've got to get permission from there." And anyway, the permission all granted. He goes, "Oh, Stan, you know, what do we have to pay?" I said, "Oh, don't worry about paying me. Just look after my family and friends in a box and just give them some food and that." And so I wasn't really thinking about West Ham. I wasn't thinking I was going to go anywhere from it. I was really doing it for my family and friends. They had a good afternoon or evening. And lo and behold, I had actually a really good game, and we won the match. And I was up against Timmy Breaker at the time, who became teammates with, and John Moncurs and all these guys. And I then got shocked that I was actually decent. And after the game, it was like Harry and Frank just chasing me on the field. And you know, who are these two guys? I mean, they're not. I didn't even know they were the managers. I mean, I thought they were like some.
What do you mean chasing you? They were trying.
Like, yeah, like it was just. They just came on the field as if they were like supporters from the thing going on. I said, "Oh, how you going, mate?" You know, and
Harry Redknapp, Harry Frank Lampard,
Frank, and they go, "Oh, yeah, kid, we like you, we love you. You know, you like Stevie Iwe, you know, from Liverpool." I didn't even know Stevie Iwe was. But having said that, I love Liverpool. I'm a Liverpool supporter. So I've made my dad happy. And then he was actually serious. And he goes, "Oh, how do you fancy coming to London?" And I thought about it for a second. I go, "Yeah, I'm once seeing the Queen, Buckingham Palace, the red letterboxes, the buses." So I was thinking about, there is no way in the world that West Ham was ever going to sign me. And I thought it was a kind of, I guess I wasn't taking it serious. I think that's probably why. But Harry and Frank definitely were. And then anyway, after all of that, I eventually got flown over to London, got picked up by a greyhound racing guy named Barry Siltman. And he goes, "I'm West Ham, but I race greyhounds for a living, and I'm an agent, and I'm this." And I thought, "Mate, where am I?" I go, "What is going on here?" things were very different in those times. I was a foreigner, even though I was English speaking from Australia. And it was very rare that an Aussie would come on over into the EPL or the Premier League. It was only really Bozza, Mark Bosnich, Robbie Slater.
So we're talking mid-90s here.
Talking mid-90s, yeah. And so the only guys there at the time was, Robbie Slater and Mark Bosnich, who are obviously on Fox now. And that was it. Really, Aussies weren't really considered, and you know, unless you were like a Bozza or a Robbie Slater. And then I got involved in this trial. So then Harry and put me on a week's trial, and I'm out playing these games against Exeter, and I'm scoring goals. And
so this is pre-season.
Pre-season
for West Ham. So West Ham. They play game every 2-3 days.
Every 2-3 days, and they just thought, oh, we'll have this kid over for a week, and he's probably not going to be any good, and we'll send him back. That's the feeling I got, and I'm running out in the, against Exeter and these other teams that we played against in the southwest, and I'm actually having good games and I'm scoring goals and I'm running to the crowd and, you know, number 11 or whatever number was at the time, I'm pretty sure it was 11, Stan Brown. I thought to myself, who's Stan Brown, right? I don't know who they named me. They were naming me all these different names, and I was turning over to Monks and John Moncada. Monks, who's Stan Brown? So he goes, oh, don't worry about it, kid. Just keep playing, you know. Go another game, score another goal, and or set up in there, you know. Number 11, Stan Allen. I'm running to the supporters, and obviously the supporters are trying to figure out who he is, right? And in the end, I think they just knew I was from Australia, and it was Skippy, and then Skippy started, Skippy. And it was, I mean, it was just very different. I just think...
So this is pre-internet. So yeah, it's all... You can do that then. So yeah, basically, he was just covering up your name so you didn't get nicked by another club.
Maybe. I don't... Well, again, Adam, I was just grateful I was there. I was grateful Harry gave me a go. And I don't think they realised I'd be any good. And it was only against Peterborough where I really just had this unbelievable match. And Harry just goes, get him off, just get him off, get him off. David Pleat was there and watching from Sheffield Wednesday. And as I was walking out, David Pleat goes, oh, kid, I love you. I come to Sheffield Wednesday. And I'm like, yep, I'm coming. I'm coming to Sheffield Wednesday. I'll be there. Yeah, no worries. Because I wasn't I didn't understand how it all went, you know. I had no agent. I had no one. I was just me and...
What happened to Barry Silkman?
Well, he was claiming to be my agent, but I don't know where Barry's a nice fella, actually, in the end. He actually did help me. And it wasn't who it was in the end. Was Les Seeley ended up becoming my agent. Because I actually had no one. Les Seeley kind of took me under his wing. He's unfortunately passed away now. He was the goalkeeper, backup, and coach. So he kind of befriended me.
And agent.
The keeper going, right? And I'm thinking, what am I getting myself into here? But
mate, it sounds like you've walked into the prequel to Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels all the stuff going on.
I got into all sorts. And then I've gone into the dressing room and Harry's come in. Carrie's then kind of had a go at me. He said, Dan, yeah, my boy, over here. You're not going anywhere. I want you to sign at West Ham. We love you. And I said, yeah, Harry, I love you too. You know, I'd love to stay here. And literally that night, I kind of got put in a hotel room in Waltham Abbey. I remember that. And Les literally stayed with me that night. And following day, Adam, I signed for West Ham. I don't really even know what I signed.
So you just lobbed at the training ground. They chucked a piece of paper in front of you and you put your name on it.
And look, admittedly, you know, Harry did say it was a cracking contract, but then I don't know how cracking that was. I didn't really make much money in that year, it must be said. But I guess it was an opportunity. And for that, especially with Harry, I was truly grateful. And I think one thing with Harry Redknapp is he really had a soft spot for me. And he did know it was going to get tough for me. And there were tough moments and... You know, he's...
In what way? How does it get tough?
I think, you know, I was very green, very naive, you know. You know, you got to remember, I was true... Because he would come up to me, he goes, hey, kid, what part of the outback are you from? I mean, you know, it'd be like... I mean, there was no conception of Australian players in those times exactly, you know. We would really not... We were ignored. We were kind of... It wasn't as if we weren't thought to be any good until... the real glory years and the Terry Venables days. And, you know, we were opened up to players like your Kewells and Lucas Neils and Muskets and Timmy Cahills and all these guys that we just pounded their league after that. But in those early couple of years, if it hadn't been for like Robbie Slater as my, luckily I was there and Robbie was there. Robbie kind of looked after me as well. It was really scary for me because I was very naive, very kind of...
How old were you? 20?
I was about 21, but really young.
A young really, 21.
Yeah. Really young. If you could put it in the ages today, it'd be like a 13, 14-year-old. You know, that's how I felt, you know. I was scared and it's intimidating. I mean, you know, my first match, I was marking Reed Hullett. And his thigh was bigger than my whole body. First match, you go, yeah, you're up against Root. And I'm like, far out. His thigh's bigger than me. And then he had his hair. I mean, it was like the Milli Vanilli days with his hair, you know, blame it on the rain. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, what's going on here? You know, and, you know, 30-odd thousand people at Upton Park, and the Upton Park supporters are really parochial, and particularly the Chicken Run there. But somehow got through that, and they actually took a liking to me. And it's a hard thing to do with the Hammers. The Hammers are real hardcore, honest supporters. And I think what they liked in me, I was different. I was this left winger, pacey, take players on, exciting. You know, I had good games, bad games, but they could always see an effort there. And I think that was the one thing I would say I did well at the Hammers for, you know.
Did you have in the back of your mind that if it doesn't go well for me here, I really don't want to go back and play NSL comparatively to the situation I find myself in? Because now you see players go off and that they do have that fallback, and it's, I'm not going to deride it, but it's just a fact of life that if you go overseas and you can't quite cut it and you're missing home, you can come home and play in a really good league back here, the A-League, not calling the NSL a bad league, but in terms of financial benefit and comfort of life, it's a lot easier for an A-League footballer to come back and do his thing. Did you find that over there, that you just didn't want to come back? Because a lot of the boys in the so-called golden generation just had that in the back of their mind. They just didn't want to come back.
It's a good question, Adam. I would answer this way, that when we left, and I put the Viduka's and the Cure, all those sort of players in there, the, you know, the guys I'm talking about, our first move was not about money. Our first move was about opportunity. And I dare say, if you talk to the Vidmars and all those sort of players, they probably didn't make any money for the first couple of years. Maybe I'm lying, but I don't think they did. Our attitude was, mine in particular, and you asked that question, was, I cannot fail. I can't fail. I've got my family, I've got my brothers, I've got people relying on me to do well. There's no cop-out here. You've got to suck it up. You've got to go through it. And I got roughed up badly, you know, roughed up badly. I mean, I look back and I think those first 3-6 months, my teammates were some of the training sessions, Adam. And you asked Robbie, you know, it was just a different experience. And for me, it was...
Well, you had teammates going through you. And...
It was just blatant. And they didn't want you there. I mean, the thing is, Adam, your own teammates didn't want you there. You're taking someone's job. You're an Australian. You're a foreigner. Who's this Aussie guy from the outback? You guys have running water. I bet you got a kangaroo. It was, you know, you talk about bullying and all that as to what it is today. But I had it all. And, you know, depression and mental health, and which is prevalent now, I would dare say I went through it. I was just lucky I had the good people around me, Robbie Slaters and these sort of guys. I remember I'd be at Robbie's house and watching videos, or watching Robbie bench press another 58 kilos or whatever Robbie
just
did.
Just 58.
You know, or whatever, just before he goes to bed, and just to tweak his pecs up again. But then, so for me, I couldn't fail, and I'd have to gruel it out. I dare say if it was today, and you got the easy cop out, you would have left.
Come back.
And here's the thing. We never had the opportunity where you could go play for, I don't know, some of these Asian clubs, but the Japanese Kawasaki, whatever they're called, and you go earn $500,000 or $1 million cash. We never had that cop out. I mean, it was
Middle
like
East, yeah.
It was playing for West Adelaide for a couple hundred bucks a week.
Yeah.
It was not. So for me, it was like, tough it up, get through it, you become a stronger person. And I did. I became tough and strong.
With the management then, when that's going on in at training grounds, and just give us a picture of what it's like, can you go to Harry Redknapp and say, Harry, they're picking on me, they're being hard, or is he putting you in that situation to find out how much you've really got inside?
A bit of both, I'd say, Adam. I think Harry... So you got to remember, when you go there, Harry is the manager, Frank Lampard's a coach, and then you've got another coach. So you're coached by the other guys, and Harry is like the supervisor, kind of watching everything, and then chips in when he needs to. But Harry is there watching, and he I remember one time I got roughed up, and he came up after a training session, and he goes, "Who did this to you?" You know, and I said, "No, Harry, it's all good, good mate, it's okay, no problem." And I think he liked that. And then in the end, I would say that my teammates ended up really loving me in the end. It was good after that.
It's like an initiation period.
Oh, initiation. I can remember, I remember playing against Nottingham Forest, and one of the players got hit by one of the Forest players, and then I came through and then hit this guy, not meaning to, mind you. I wasn't that sort of player. And then ended up getting the ball, scoring a goal or setting up the goal, and I got mad at the match in that game, got a bike and gave it to someone in the crowd. And
a push bike?
They gave me a push bike.
What?
It was a bloody, this racing bike, thinking I'm the next Lance Armstrong or something. And then I just gave it to someone in the crowd. And then those one or two players come up to me and goes, "Mate, you're one of us now." It was almost that was a turning point for me. And then before you know it, the initiation was taking me to a pub. I get a pint put in front of me. I've never seen a pint before in my life. I never had a drink before in my life. And then they're throwing three vodka shots in. It goes, "Get it down here." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm going to drink that." And you know, and I've had about three sips and I'm gone. I'm done.
That's a that was a precursor to Russia 2018.
Yeah, we had a few of those drinks, yeah.
It's just the way it was over there.
In those times, yeah. I mean, it's all refined now. As you know, you've got 17 assistants before you actually do anything, you know?
Yeah.
I better check his muscle tone. Or hang on a minute. He's had, you can't give him that chicken. He's got to have corn-fed chicken nowadays. I mean, we had chicken with steroids in there. I mean, that's just how it was.
What were some of your favourite memories in terms of, you know, standing in tunnels before games or bumping into big names on the field and thinking to yourself, I'm your equal. Like, even though you've got the big name and you've got the flash car and the big house or whatever, that out here, I'm actually your equal, and that makes you feel, I'd imagine, pretty good about yourself.
Yeah, look, I think later on I probably appreciate it more. But at the time, I can remember being one particular one. I was locked in the tunnel with Man United, and it was only when they had, like, the team that won everything. You know, so you looked at it, it was Cantona, Giggs, Beckham, and I never looked left, ever, to the players. I used to look down and look at my teammates, look at my boots, and just, you know, you're nervy, you're jumpy, you know, butterflies. And I'd do the mistake, I look left, Roy Keane. And Roy Keane's positioned straight, looking at me, waiting for me to turn. He's not looking forward, he's looking sideways. And he just looked at me, and I've caught his eyes, and these piercing green eyes just engulfed me. He swallowed me. He goes, Ozzy, you're dead. Oh, you said some other choice words before. I can't swear on this, I guess. He goes, "Ozzy, you're dead. You hear me? You're dead. First tackle, I'm doing you." And I'm like, I looked at him. I thought it was Satan, Lucifer, all the devils. I swallowed Roy Keane's devils, you name it, the Red Devils. It was him, right? He came into me. And I'm like, man, this guy's scary, all right? And I go, "Roy, I love you. I'm like, you're my favourite player."
Did you say that?
I said, "I love you, Roy." And then Rio Ferdinand starts laughing, because Rio was at West Ham at the time, then moved to United or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And I said, "Roy, I love you. I go, you're my favourite Man United player." And but I didn't know what I was saying, you know? And then I'm running out in the field. I'm going, "Oh, my God, he's going to kill me." And and sure enough, first tackle, he's just belted me. And he goes, "I told you, I'm doing..." And he just would talk to me while I'm on the ground. I go, "Can you just lay off me, will you? All right, just go away." So, I mean, but this is all the that's the whole intimidation thing, you know. And Roy Keane, he was probably the number one guy at it, you know. Mm. Each of those big name teams, they had it, you know. You had like a Dennis Wise at Chelsea at the time. You had a Roy Keane, and you look at Arsenal, they had your Vieiras and Martin Keown. Martin Keown was scary anyway. I mean, and he'd step on your toe and he'd say, and he'd look as if, what did I do? So you'd have all these guys, these players, and then, but then you mentioned something there, Adam, before you say, you realise that the players, I can remember like the great Arsenal side where you had like Bergkamp, Henri, Overmars, Petit, Vieira, Parler, Dixon, Baldy, Keown, Adams, Winterburn, Seaman. I've rattled them all out for you. And Ian Wright was on the bench. And you know, I was lucky to be on that field against these guys when they were the Invincibles. And it didn't matter about money. It didn't matter. It was a moment in your life, then you talk about memories, that I've just belted out those names in 10 seconds that I'll never forget.
Yeah. Well, you...
You know?
There's the story that you nearly became one of their teammates.
I nearly did.
So was that from West Ham to... Because you played a few years at West Ham, and then you went to Birmingham City and you played another over 100 Premier League games at Birmingham City as well.
Yeah. Oh, look, you're right. I mean, there was a moment there where Arsenal were looking to sign a backup to Mark Overmars. Arsene Wenger and Pat Rice, they took a real liking to me. And at that time, they were looking to sign players of age around the 23, 24-year-old mark. So my name was there, a left-sided player, backup. Someone's going to play 20 or 30 matches a year. Perfect. That's a perfect one for me. Somehow that communication from Harry and Frank and whatnot never really got to me, or it was talked about and never really happened, whether it was transfer fee, whether Harry wanted to hang on to me a bit longer. In the end, they ended up signing Glenn Helder for about £1.5 million. And it was just one of those moments where you missed the big four, you know, an opportunity to pay. Mm. At that time, you know, you talked about Arsenal, Manchester United, Liverpool, Spurs or something, you know, one of those big clubs.
It was before Chelsea got
before Chelsea and the Man City, before those big ones. But, you know, and I guess I kind of wonder, you know, with that opportunity. But other than that, I still am grateful, very grateful. Harry was really good to me. And even when he did sell me, he didn't really want to sell me, but it was kind of funny how he did sell me.
Go on.
He goes, I love you, but I got to sell you. And I said, Harry, I really love you. I don't want to go. I go, I love it here. I go, I want to be West Ham for life. He goes, no, you ain't. You're going. And I said, I bought you for £300,000, kid. I'm selling you for $2 million. Great business, son. I need to bring in Paolo Wanchope. You're going. I said, no, Harry, I don't want to go, Harry. I go, Harry, let me stay, please. And I didn't understand how all that worked either. I just thought you go to one club and you're done. But... it was probably a fitting sale and a fitting buy, because I really truly found an unbelievable club in Birmingham City. I found my home. I really did. And when I went there the first week, I thought, gee, what am I got myself into? But then...
Why is that?
Because at that time, the chairman at that time were David and Ralph Gold, the Gold brothers, and Dave Sullivan. And they're the owners of...
Who ended up, ironically, at West Ham.
At West Ham, yeah. And that, funny enough, Dave Gold was a massive West Ham fan. And that's where he kind of noticed me. So they were all keen on bringing me on board. And they just bought the club or taken over the debts of the club, not by the club. And it was at its infancy stage where, you know, all the infrastructure was on its way, but it hadn't been done. I thought, geez, this is different to West Ham. And, you know, so I thought to myself, oh, what's going... But literally within the first few weeks, I was just home. There was a connection with the fans. I played my best football. You know, we achieved things. I was under great managers, particularly Steve Bruce. Steve Bruce and I, there was this respect and trust between us. The chairman, I had an honesty between the chairman and myself, and even the way they did their contracts. They would just say it. Miss Karen Brady, she was the director at that time. But there was this synergy. There was this really good synergy. And I truly adore the club. And I also do love West Ham, and I'm grateful West Ham, but it was a transition period. I kind of knew what West Ham were doing at the time. They were having to bring these players up and sell the likes of Frank Lampard and Rio Ferdinand, Cole, Carrick, Defoe.
Amazing production.
You can rattle off, and it's as good as the Man United players, you know, when they won everything. And then I found my home, Adam, and I had some unbelievable years at Birmingham, and really with the fans, even today, I often always think of the club. Some days I wake up thinking I'm going to St Andrews, but I'm not. I'm going out digging a trench or something. You know, sometimes I wake up thinking, hey, it's Stanley, the Blues. We're going out St Andrews. You're going to run. I've got the game replaying in my head, and I'm like, I can't wait to go out and play.
Steve Bruce, you mentioned his name. Now, I'm a Newcastle fan, and it's going to take a lot for people like me to be convinced that Steve Bruce is a good manager. But why did you click so heavily with him? And do you keep an eye on what he's doing in a club like Newcastle now?
Oh, look, if you follow Brucey's, call it Brucey, you know. Got that connection now.
You can do that.
Yeah, I can do that. The thing with Brucey, he's got an ability where he can take a club, build a club. He needs a bit of time, you know. And he's particularly good with the clubs where, I guess, the expectation isn't as high. And then he surprises everyone.
Mm.
And that's what he's brilliant at. You know, you look at what he's done at Hull and Wiggins and all these sort of Sunderlands. And, you know, he gets clubs promoted, keeps them up, builds them, gets them established, and then leaves to his next challenge. Newcastle, it's a massive club. It's a huge, huge club. 50,000 people almost every week. It'll take a little bit longer, but they just got to kind of give him a go, you know, kind of just back him a little bit.
What is he, a man manager or is he a
great man manager?
Tactical manager.
I think he's a great man manager. I think...
Why is that? He puts an arm around you when you need it, gives you a kick up the arse, or is just...
I think a bit of all of that, but he picks and chooses what plays he does it with. You know, I know with me, he would come up to me and he'd say, kid, take Monday off. Just, I don't want you training. He goes, I need you good on Saturday. I don't need you good on Tuesday. Because go in there, because I trust you. I know who you are. Because I don't want you throwing your body out. You're trying to recover. You have a big game. There'd be things like that. There'd be things like a couple of games coming up in 2 days. He'd say, Stan, I need to speak to you. I goes, you know, I want to play in one of these games and I'm deciding which one it is. I feel we're going to get points on this game, and that's the game I need you to play because you'll get me points.
Hmm.
And it was this conversation, you're having an honest conversation. It wasn't like I'm just dropping you or doing this or I'm doing that. And yeah, sure, there were games I was dropped and there was games I was brought in. That's natural in this industry. But for me, I guess it was him, like, we talk about Raoul Blanco initially, was more of a father kind of thing. Mm. And then you talk about the managers like Terry Venables, who was also that way. Brucey, it was these type of guys you go out and you want to die for these guys. You know, with Brucey, I'd put my head in front of anything.
What was the derbies like with Villa?
We had the keys to the city. I can remember when I first signed for the Blues, and I remember the supporters going up to go, Stanley, just beat the Villa. Just beat the Villa. That's all it was, Stanley. Beat the Villa. And I'm like, yeah, but don't we want to get like stay in the league and beat the Villa, yeah. And then it would be. It took me a while to absorb it
because Bozza says that it's the only time the police have come to the training ground before a game to say, "Hey guys, it's going to be pretty full on when you're playing this match. Yeah. Just be advised if something gets way out of hand that we're coming in and we're taking control."
No, Buzz is right. A lot of these kind of meetings were organised. They were organised meetings, and they weren't organised by what you call hooligans, i.e., you know, the guys that you think have got tats and this and that, and they look like they're hooligan. No, these are like lawyers and accountants that are wearing. They look like you. They look like you. They look like you. Right. Guys that you think, we'll bring him home to mum, you know, mum would love this guy, you know. So you're talking about sophisticated, educated people that are organising these bashathons or whatever that you call them.
Before and after the game.
You know, And it was like, then the games got changed. So there was never 8 o'clock in the evening kickoffs because that was too long to have too many drinks to get fired up. So all our kickoffs were lunchtime. So basically having eggs on toast with a pint, right?
Were they and ferocious, those games?
They were. There was something extra about it. You, when the ball went out over the line, you kind of waited for the ball to get thrown back in. I didn't go and chase it. I said, oh, I'll have that ball. No, you ain't. And then the ball get thrown about 5 metres the other way, and then the ball boys would get them. So those games had an extra spice in it. And look, to be honest, my time there, we had the better of Villa. We just did. And we had a guy named Robbie Savage that played for us. And he was like the perfect player to wind up anybody for that matter. But you wanted him on your team. Mm. People underestimate someone like a Robbie Savage in their side. He was brilliant to play with. Brilliant for us. And great guy. But he was hated by everybody else.
Yeah.
And he would wind up Villa. Particularly, I remember Dion Dublin, the nicest guy in the world. Got a red card. Robbie Savage ran them out. And that's what happens. You talk about your Roy Keynes. You talk about these sort of guys, they find a way to upset the other team. And that was normally the difference. And I remember poor old Peter Enkelman, the goalkeeper. I don't think he played. I think after he played against the against us.
Oh, the one that went through the...
Yeah.
Did you play that game?
Yeah. We won 2-0, I think it was.
For anyone who hasn't seen it, look it up on YouTube. It's a throw-in, and Enkelman has gone to trap the ball. It's gone under his legs.
Under his leg. Goal. And Jeff Horsfield's gone on and kicked the ball and just tapped it in, basically. That's what nerves do. That's what these big games do,
How was he after that?
Look, truth be told, I don't think he recovered.
Yeah.
You know, how can you, you know? You talk about moments, you talk about even the Liverpool keeper in the Champions League game where
Loris Karius.
Yeah, you don't recover. These moments, they play in your head. You don't want to leave your house, you know. You live in the area. Everyone knows you. And it's devastating. And, I tell you, I mean, and he was a good keeper.
Yeah. I just want to get your thoughts overall on English football in that golden period where the Premier League went from one thing, First Division football, to another, and then off the back of that, it kind of, spiralled into what it is today. And the football today is, say, a little different to what it was. But I get the feeling, especially with a player like yourself, very direct, like you were there for a purpose, is to just burn down the wing and get the ball in and get it to the highly paid guys and knock it in the back of the net. There were other things that you had to do in a game,
I was pretty good at it. Yeah. But, I'll take that.
Like you were exceptional at that. And has football become a little overcomplicated? And I'm not going to get into details about how kids are being coached now, but just in a general sense at the top level, do you get the feeling that it's become overcomplicated, or is it just a changing of the times and it's gone a different direction?
Yeah, I think a little bit of both, but predominantly the latter. I think, obviously, we've harped on so much about this technical aspect. And I remember sitting down in these meetings and these directors saying, right, we're looking at players that can juggle the ball, flick it about behind the neck, balance it on your butt, then flick it up. Well, I only know Archie Thompson and Jason Kleiner can do that, right? They're the only two guys that can do that. Juggle the ball while having a conversation, talking to you. And I then put my hand up and said, well, if that's what you're looking for the next Australian player, I never would have played for Australia. Because as you rightly pointed out, what I had, guys like Robbie Slater, who I think are missing in the game today, Brett Emmertons, guys that would just get the ball, turn defence into attack. Doesn't matter. There were three or four players. I took them on. I even forgot where the line was and took the gate on. Then I took the suburb on. And then I went up to the suburb, came back.
Forrest Gump.
And then went back again. And they're saying, Robbie would say, oh, you've gone through the gate, mate. Come back. Cross the ball. So I guess we're joking a little bit about it, but that's what players like I had, Scotty Chipperfield, Danny Tiaros, Harry Kewells, Harry Kewells was refined a lot more than us. But and your Robbie Slater. Robbie was menacing. Robbie was like this dynamic, brute force in pushing defenders back. And whilst Robbie's probably a bit more technical than I am, we were never as technically gifted as some of these other guys. But I tell you what, geez, balls got put in the box nonstop. And I remember guys like Johnny Hartson and Paul Kitson, they said, Stan, when you get the ball, we know where it's going and we just can't wait to get into the box. And, You know, you're watching sometimes and I'm like, cross the ball. Hurry up, just put it in that zone. And you're just wanting it to happen. And I'm watching our boys now. And they can't just whip it in.
It's different though. It's a balancing. Like you talk of Roy Keane.
Yeah.
Who are the Roy Keanes that are coming through? Who are the big strong defenders like a Martin Keown? And I suppose you can look at a Virgil van Dijk and think, well, that's the prototypical modern day defender who can defend and use his body really well and play. But it's just the tweaks in the game are really interesting. I'm wondering what the next progression is.
I think I don't want us to forget about that type of player. You know, pace. I'll take pace all day long. I think you can work on somebody's touch a little bit. But if you get pace, you give your defence a breather. You know, you just push the teams back. And I think Graham Arnold is someone that is looking at that now. I think he's looking at pace because he remembers, I played with Graham Arnold. So Graham Arnold will know what we did well at. And I guess combine this technical, because we've got some really good technical players now that have the ability to get the ball, keep the ball. But mixing up and having players express their own abilities, I always believe, show me what you've got, especially in that front third. Mm. That's a license to display, you're on your own then. Go express yourself. And I think a lot of the time, in particularly what I noticed when I was under Gus Hiddink and that, is they didn't let you do that. They wanted, no, kick the ball, pass. I fell asleep on the eighth pass. And then the ball came. Oh, shit, I got it. Sorry. That's their method. Kick the ball. And whilst I get it, but I tell you what, I just like a lung-busting run there when I see someone like a Daniel Lozani was a breath of fresh air that we all said in the World Cup when he was, and he's like, oh, brilliant. We're getting finally someone that's...
I remember sitting next to you. It was like, just give him the ball. Yeah. Just give him the ball.
Let's go. Let's just go.
I just want to see him get the ball.
Yeah. And there was this... You're off your seat, aren't you? You're kind of like, God, this expectation, this... and I think we had that in our time, but I guess everybody didn't realise just how good that was because there was a few of us like that, you know?
Mm.
And I think it's changing again. I think this, like you said, I guess it... The game has adapted, it has changed, and you're trying to produce this complete player. But I think you need different dynamics to make the team.
Just before I get onto the subject of the national team, one thing I do want to bring up, and I've heard through some of the other guys, you're not a big fan of flying.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm just trying to process this. How can you be an international footballer living on the other side of the world and not like planes? I don't get it.
I'd say I did it for my country. I did it for the country. I did it for my family. I did it for everybody else.
You can't stand flying.
I can't stand flying. I don't know what it is. It's this, I say to myself, no, I'm great. Oh, I'm brilliant. I'm great fly. Get in my chair. Start hearing all the noises. Something happens. I start tweaking. I start sweating. I start shaking. Whoever's next to me, well, I'm holding their knee.
Who's the worst person you're next to in a situation like that?
I think I'm the worst. I've always had... I mean, I've been like next to Robbie. Robbie's not great either, but...
No, but someone who winds you up about it.
Oh, yeah, someone winds me up. Absolutely. I know everyone winding me up. Oh, we're going to crush today, Stan. I'll crush it today. I didn't like that. We're up in the air, and I'm like, I'm hearing a noise, and the wheel's not coming down because we went on some of these airlines, Pterodactyl Airways or some of them. I reckon I flew on Flintstone Airways, And some of the wheels were just not coming down. And the guy's trying to do these manoeuvres like it's an air show. And I said, what's he doing? I go, guys, I think we're going down. We're going down. Oh, yeah, we're going down. And then, you know, but look, and then there's like flying over turbos. I mean, I still can't handle turbos. I don't care what you say, bumps in the road. I prefer bumps in the road. Don't give me bumps in the air. And then anyway, I've gotten better. The planes have gotten better as well. They've refined, like soccer players. I think they've refined. I try and get through it nowadays. I mean, it's all, as you said, you fly everywhere these days. But look, it was, it probably aged me, I dare say. But I kind of just, a lot of the times I would say, this is one thing I really did say. I'm on the plane with Timmy Cahill and Harry Kuehl, and there is no way God is going to take these two guys away. So no chance. I'm all right, right? I go, Harry's on the plane, I'm okay. So you've got like, Harry was like One Direction, wasn't he? Like this footballer, boy band, politics. I mean, I don't know what the guy did, you know? And then you got Timmy Cahill, and you're thinking, mate, there is no chance the plane's going down. Not with Timmy.
Well, you're still here, Stan. You've done a lot of flying because you live in Perth and you have to fly to get anywhere apart from Perth. With the national team, so you played through a lot of eras. So you went from, you played through a bit of the Eddie Thompson, Frank Farina, Terry Venables, of course, Hiddink.
Yeah.
Who's your pick out of that lot in terms of what they did for your career?
Yeah, I think a combination of Frank Farina and Terry Venables. For me, Frank, great man manager, Frank Farina. And he took and obviously Frank had a good era of players too.
Mm.
And, you know, what I liked about Frank is he'd say, Lazar, look, I don't know how you cross the ball. I don't tell you how to cross the ball. Just cross the ball. I say, all right, Frank. He goes, is there anything else you need? Oh, no, Frank, just can you tell him to get out of my way when I start running? And he goes, oh, that's easy. Right, all you lot, get out of his way when he runs. So, Frank obviously was blessed with the players. I mean, he had to decide some games between Paul Oakon and Ned Zelich. I mean, again, you've got guys when they run. I mean, Paul Oakon, his calves rub together when he runs. We had the Vaseline. Between him and Vinny Grello had the biggest calves. And I'd have to put Vaseline on the calves so he can get blisters. I mean, these guys are like beasts in the midfield. And then you got Ned Zelich, who was just a freak on his day. But it was the ability of trying to play these guys because it was obviously, you know, there was also the situation of how do you put a Lampard and a Gerrard in the same team. We had the same thing, but we had Ned Zelich and Paul Oakon.
And you factor in coming back, like looking after your club career, coming back. Yeah. I don't know if that ever became a problem for you.
No, it didn't for me, but guys like Bozza, Dukes, Harry Kuehl and these sort of guys, I mean, clubs didn't want to release it. All of us for that matter, they didn't want to release us. And it was because they didn't really... I don't think Australia wasn't really considered to be like a power country, you know?
Respected Australian football. Yeah.
In that time, just in that time. Obviously, that changed, especially when we beat England 3-1 over at Upton Park, which was a night. and things did change. And particularly Terry Venables, going on to that question. Terry Venables, I would have just loved to play under him on a week-to-week basis. Because I just played the best football under him. He just simplified the game for me and just made me really understand the game really easily. And you think the game's we complicate it, but I think great managers break it down. They give you certain tasks and all they want you to do is repeat it, repeat, repeat, repeat. Don't start throwing in all these things that you got to do and complicate it, because when you go out in the game, your mind is going that quick. You just kind of want to have this repetitive action that you want to keep going. And Terry Venables had that ability.
I've heard, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, that Venables, at half time, he used to go around, he didn't give the big speech in front of the group. He'd go around to each player individually, and if he was happy, he'd just go, keep it going. Or if he needed to make a tweak, it was like, so he'd individually coach the players at half time. Is that...
Yeah, he wasn't a screamer or a growler or... Even when things weren't so good, he was just this analytical, you know, and he was just thinking. But when he spoke, it made sense. It went through you, you know. It really made, you know, whereas sometimes like someone like Harry, he would if he got wound up, I mean, I ended up with an egg and watercress sandwich all over my head, you know. Because he just kicked it and he'd say, you think you're footballers? You ain't football, you're useless. Then he'd... volleyed this plate of sandwich. I think it landed on me and Robbie. And
at halftime,
it was like the end of the game when
you got rolled.
When we got rolled, but then Harry was a great winner. So yeah. Harry was also a magnificent winner. He goes, "How stay you like Lazarus the King? You want Monday off? Take the week off." come back on Saturday. And I'm like, oh, it's all right, Harry. Kid, have 4 days. Oh, mate. And so
Venables was a little more level and grounded, even though, I don't know if you can remember at halftime of the MCG game.
I remember it. Look, it was just...
The Iran
game. Yeah, I remember that game, don't worry. Mm. I mean, it was... You know, we should have been 5-0 up. Had Dukes and Aurelio put away a few more of their chances because, you know, we really should have had him dead and buried, you know. But I guess it was just, he just goes, keep it going, guys. Same thing, you know, first 5 minutes of the game, just, you know, make sure we're there. And then obviously things spiraled out of our hands, really. And I don't need to go into it, but a lot of people know with the idiot that came on and just upset the momentum. And it's a real shame because that team deserved to be in a World Cup. It really deserved to. That was France 98. I felt we would have done well. We would have been the surprise packet. It would have been, you know, when they say, oh, who's the smoky? Who's the dark horse? It would have been us. Because we just had everyone primed and we had like young Harry Kewell and we had like weapons, you know, and fit Harry Kewell. You're kidding me. That guy's unbelievable. So that's a shame for the game, shame for our country. We really needed it. The country at that time was on its knees in the game. It was just a nail in the coffin for us that it just set us back, you know.
We all enjoyed as fans the 2006 World Cup. Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed it for the fact is that we tried so hard to make it, and I enjoyed it for the country. I enjoyed it for what was needed for the game. Did I personally enjoy it? Yeah, I did. I probably did, you know, because I was with the players and that. I guess it was a time where I guess I didn't really enjoy being under Gus Hiddink, I think is my... But he did really well for us, so...
You had to put your own...
Yeah, I put my things aside.
Yeah.
And that was fine, and the country benefited. We got to a World Cup, and Gus did great. You know, he did great. You know,
because he tried to in the preamble before it. You had that fitness camp, and he tried to break you, but he didn't.
Yeah,
that was kind of way. That must have been satisfying because he couldn't.
Well, no, but it was good because afterwards I did tell him, okay, you didn't break me, to his face. Because what I didn't like is things that he'd said, I'm going to break that Greek. Well, I'm Australian. Mm. I'm not Greek. I'm Greek background. I'm representing the country. So why would you go and say to someone, I'm going to break that Greek? And why is it a personal thing? I would rather him saying, look, I don't know why you picked me. Why'd you pick me then?
Did you, like, in the first meeting or something, fart when you shouldn't have? It's a mystery.
Really, didn't really speak. I mean, I reckon he spoke about 5 words to me in the whole... Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's weird. But then afterwards, you know, it was when we caught up again, it was all okay. We started talking to me as if we were mates again. It's like, unbelievable. I don't know this guy can turn. But having said all of that, he did really well. I mean, you know, what he did at that time got us through. I felt against Italy, I felt he let us down against Italy. I'm sorry, but he did. You know, 10 men, not making any changes and playing that. I just, he can say he was waiting for extra time, but I'm sorry. You don't wait for extra time. You make it happen. And we were playing with 8 midfielders and, you know, I was on the bench. I mean, and we had injuries. We had, Harry wasn't fit. Brett Emerton wasn't fit. We didn't have, was crying out for like myself and I think it was, I'm not sure it was Johnny or...
Johnny was on the bench.
Johnny. Yeah. We really needed to come on and we might as well lose 3-0.
Yeah.
So it was, I guess, moments like... So if we're going back and asking whether I was personal... No, I was... Look, I was always about Australia. I always... That was first and foremost, the players. I was close with all the boys, Mark Bresciano's, Vinnie Grella's, and I was really happy. Look, it was the whole thing. Just on a personal thing, it was just something between Gus and I. But and that's okay. It's fine. It was just one of those moments, you know.
You got your fit.
He did. I was the only one that trained 31 days consecutively, right? And I'd play a game, 90 minutes. Yeah, Lazar, you're training. All right, cheers, Gus. No worries. Okay, and you're doing the runs afterwards, and you're running on your own, and you can run back to the hotel. Cheers, Gus. Anything else? Do you want to do some bench pressing and sit-ups before dinner?
Geez, you must have been ripped.
I was good. I was really good. I tell you what, I was like, but look, in saying that, Gus, he got us all fed. He did. He, you know, we'd seen out games. I mean, but yeah, he would just make these moves at certain times that got you bewildered. And maybe there wasn't anything personal. Maybe it was just that's how it was. It was just his way. And so I didn't. I guess at the time might have taken a little bit different to now. And I look back and I think, that's okay. I would have loved to have come on against Italy. I think Gus got it right for 95% of the World Cup. I just think I would have loved to have thrown the dice 15 minutes to go. Lazar going, just let me get a ball in. I would have got him a ball in.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, well.
Yeah, but you never know.
You can't change it. Speaking of not being able to change it, like, looking back now, you came back and played a little bit with Perth, but then you retired, and you're not hands-on in the game. You're obviously an interested observer right now, but you're enjoying what you're doing, and you're doing a little bit. Well, you called a game with us at Fox a couple of weeks ago, and you go on tours with the Fanatics and things like that. But like, you're not hands-on like some of the others are. Is there any feeling to do that, or are you busy what you're doing in your own life?
Yeah, look, I think during my career, I didn't think that football was going to provide me enough financial income and stuff to carry me for the rest of my life. And so I was preparing myself for life after football. And I think a lot of players should do that, regardless. And I guess for me, I started all this property sort of thing going on. And for me, it was an easy transition to close a chapter of football and then literally the very next day go straight into football, not wake up 8:30, ready to train or get to training, because it's hard for players when that day finally comes and you stop it, and then, you know, you say all your goodbyes and that, but come Monday morning, you wake up and it's an eerie feeling, you know. For me, it wasn't. I kind of got in, and you know what, Adam? Sometimes I forget I'm a footballer. I was ever a footballer. I look at myself sometimes, who was that? He actually looks all right. He's not a bad player. I go, and I think it's me. I can't believe it was me. So sometimes I didn't even realise I was a footballer. And now I kind of do other things, and a lot of it's property-based. But I love the game. The game's in your blood. Is there an area for me to come into? Well, I hope so, somewhere. I guess I just haven't found where I'm at. And as you realise, I'm in God's country in Perth. So other than me meeting up with Roger Federer and Hemsworth at Rottnest Island with the Quokkas, I mean, where do you want me to go? I mean, there's only about two spots at Glory. Somehow I'm not going to get there. And Papa's done an amazing job there. So there really isn't. I guess the outs for me are not there. But that's okay, because I guess I'm not pushing it either. So for me, it's, I love the game. I want our boys to do well. I'm a big fan of the league in general, big fan of the players. I have no motive. There's no bias. I just want good players produced. I'd love to see more of our boys playing in the top leagues. I'd love to see the Aussie team progress in the World Cup and get to the next stage like we did. And hopefully Graham Arnold can do that. You know, so I guess for me, I don't have an agenda, but I'm always there. So, you know, through people like yourself, Warren Livingston that runs the Fanatics, and people call me, I'll always help wherever I can.
Yeah. Well, Stan, hopefully in, what is it now, 3 years' time, we get to Qatar. I don't know where we're going to find a beer, but we'll try and find a beer.
We'll be under a tent. air-conditioned tent.
We'll be like Bedouins, just living life in the desert and enjoying it. But whatever the case, if you're around and I'm around and Boz is around as well, we'll try and have some fun. But, mate, thanks so much for the past hour. It's been fascinating. Love the chat. Some of the stories, fantastic. You're a legend, mate. Thank you.
Thanks.